if something you're working on happens on the scale of years, then stopping for 1 month to maybe get it done 4 months sooner, that can actually pay off. Because 1 month might feel like a long time, but if the scale of the project is much bigger than that, then it's not actually wasting time if you're getting energy back and giving your brain time to reset.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH. Exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV and intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%. GM, GM, everyone. My name is Degarchi, the host of Scraping Bits, and today I'm with a special guest, Jeffrey Scholes from Rare Skills. How's it going, friend?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. Living it up. Just for the people that aren't familiar with you, who are you and what do you do?
Sure. Well, I'm Jeffrey Scholes, as was introduced. I'm the founder of Rare Skills, and Rare Skills is a developer education and training company focused on advanced topics in Web3. So most of the people who study at the school have been in the industry for some time. And the primary things that we teach are more advanced topics in Solidity and zero knowledge proofs. Those are our primary areas of focus right now.
Yeah, interesting. And you have this reputation of being a terrific researcher, obviously, if you're teaching it, right? In a variety of fields, you know, you speak about ZK, which is not easy to grasp, but then also blockchain. And you mentioned before this, you've done ML, which you don't teach, but you might get into it. It begs the question of how do you do that? How do you effectively learn each subject to the point where you can teach it to other people? And you're doing multi-fields, multi-subjects, or disciplines rather. So how can you quickly grasp a subject to the point where you can teach it?
Well, I'm not starting from zero. That's something I will say. I definitely don't want to give the impression like, oh, hey, I'm interested in this topic. Now, you know, 4 months later, I've consumed all of the literature. I think one absolutely huge head start that I had was what I studied in graduate school was pretty related to blockchain, even though this was before Ethereum launched. So that was computational theory. And most blockchains, aside from Bitcoin nowadays, are basically computers. And so they reuse a lot of the same concepts that were areas that I was researching in and studying. So that really gave a big head start. And then I was doing blockchain on and off since 2015. I was more interested in consensus algorithms than smart contracts, but at least I had that going for me. So when it came to stuff like, okay, how do compilers, EVM, how do you model computation? That kind of stuff was already pretty intuitive to me by that point. ZK stuff, I mean, I had done some cryptography before. There's actually not that much overlap between regular cryptography and ZK, I feel. I feel like they're not as related as they look on the surface. But I had done some related stuff, so at least that made it manageable. And then before I launched the ZK course, I had been studying it on and off for a year. Okay. It was one of those, like, at first it was like one of those things I was doing undisciplined study in. Oh, this is interesting. Oh, okay, I'll dabble in it for a little bit. Oh, shoot, this is getting hard. I'm going to quit. But 4 months before the course launched, though, I got really, really serious about organizing. And then a month after we launched the course, a month or two after that, we published the ZK book. That was the accumulation of 4 months of full-time effort. By that point, I was not investing a whole lot in the Solidity stuff because at least the curriculum was in a state I was pretty happy with. I'm not the only person writing at Rare Skills. There's other people too. So they could at least keep publishing things while I was working in the background on ZK things. There's definitely more of a backstory that I'm just like a superhuman or something like that.
But obviously with any, you know, researcher, especially when you're teaching, you want to give the correct education, right? And so, I mean, I did this with my articles. I couldn't release something unless it was completely perfect. And obviously, people have different strategies for researching, and they kind of find what's most effective for them. And so what was most effective for you? You know, and how did you kind of adjust? Obviously, you learn from your past experience of researching and fine-tune your strategies for learning something new. So what has that become of now?
I think this is something you need obviously something that's going to give you feedback about how close you are to the correct answer or not, right?
Yeah.
And I think because I had a more theoretical background, so for me that was proof writing. If you have a correct proof, then you figured it out. I think But I've also spent most of my professional life doing engineering, and the correct answer is, does your code work or not? I think using both as kind of a guiding principle for, am I on the right path or not? It gives you that immediate feedback of, are you on the right track?
Sustainable, consistent. Yeah, I got you. Yeah. For me, it was the same. It was a, you know, start a project, and once you reach a problem, can you solve this? If not, what do you need to learn? And that was the immediate, you know, feedback of, okay, this is what you have to learn. Here's the reason why to progress, basically, in your project that you want to finish. But I think for me, learning math is actually quite different, because you're not given a big project with this aspiring goal of making it do XYZ. It's more solve problem in textbook. And for what reason, though? The reason you could argue is, I want to learn this, but there's got to be a further reason. And I wouldn't say it's the same as applying it to a big code base or a big project. It's more of like learning the skill to then apply later. But then why wouldn't you just try to apply it initially and then learn it? That's kind of what I've been approaching my learning as. I struggled to kind of convert that into math, though. Like, how can I bring math into that same equation? It doesn't really work with me, and I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, that's actually something that I had a very hard time describing to a lot of people, because I tell a lot of engineers, if you spend time studying data structures and algorithms, for example, then computer science in general is going to be easier for you. And the response that I'll typically get back is, hey, I've never actually inverted a binary tree in real life, so why am I studying this? Intuitively, I felt like, okay, I feel like there's something wrong with that response, but I can't really quite put my finger on what it is. And then eventually, I think it clicked after thinking about it for such a long time, is if you're going to be a good computer scientist, then it's largely about finding really good representation of your data such that the operations you care about are easy. And having that mental ability to do that is something that can be trained with very directly with stuff like data structures and algorithms, and I would say math. But where it gets misleading is, okay, I didn't directly use the data structures and algorithms, but I used the same mental muscle that made me good at it. That's where I've seen it go. And I mean, I definitely think people can go wrong spending too much time in training and studying problems and not doing what they actually should be doing. That can be a trap. But I think it's a minority of people who fall into that trap. More often than not, is a lot of learners lack a framework to put information in, and they can't digest information in chunks rather than piece by piece. So for example, if you're reading the code base of like the Solana EVM or Solana VM or Ethereum VM or something like that, if you don't already have an idea of what, you know, a Merkle tree is, for example, then you're not going to have any idea of what you're looking at when you look at the state tree. If you tried to build that thing up from first principles, you're going to get stuck. So having the right sort of tools in your toolbox to conceptualize things helps you learn in chunks rather than piece by piece. But knowing in advance what those chunks are, there's definitely, I think there's, to a certain element, it's a random process. Like, should I be learning before let's say I want to work on clients or something like that? Well, multi-threading is probably important, depending on the implementation of the client. But how much time should I spend learning about multi-threading? Well, I don't think it's really possible to derive an optimal answer for that. You just kind of have to start and then iterate.
Yeah, it's interesting, because it's kind of like a chicken and the egg problem, as you know, which one comes first. But the answer is really both, to be honest, because you need a mixture of both. You need a little bit of, you need a high level overview to know why or what to build, because without, you know, a preface amount of knowledge, you wouldn't know, you know, what even is this, what am I doing, what is possible, what is not possible. But then at like a high level, obviously, but then you go and experiment, you think of a project, you go try it, and then you hit a problem and you're like, how do I solve this? And then you go on and learn. And then you go back to the theoretical to learn, and then you apply. And that's when, you know, we really make the strong connections in our mind.
That's a really good way to do it.
Yeah. And I think the high level is so important, because how can you fill in a frame without the frame? It's like a glass of water. Without the glass, the water goes everywhere. And so you need the high level, which in this context is a glass, to put the water in, which is then, you know, applying the theoretical. And I think that's the right way of thinking, because that's what I've done and it's worked tremendously well, but I haven't done it with math. So I don't know in that area. Yeah. But it's, for the most part, anything non-math / theoretically heavy, we need like a certain amount of knowledge to actually do it, seems to work at a practical sense. But again, I'm not an academic at all. I'm like a tinkerer, really. In your experience, what is kind of like the 20% that creates the 80% results in terms of like researching and understanding?
Not giving up and just being really determined to keep going. That's honestly like the majority of it. I know that's not a profound answer, but in terms of what...
But it's realistic, yeah.
Yeah, that's just really it. Now, I mean, I'm not saying... There are people who work hard and go at it for a long time and don't see results, so I'm definitely not saying that's a sufficient factor, but it's absolutely a necessary factor. And then it goes past necessary at certain points where suboptimal strategies can be made to work quite effectively just because you're putting a lot of effort in. Mm-hmm. So that's because, I mean, that's definitely something I've seen with myself is just, are you willing to hang in there until you get lucky and make a connection? And that is that's psychologically painful, and you definitely need a good amount of psychological pain tolerance to
keep going
through that. Well, also aware with all of like, am I on a dead end right now and should I give up, right? Or iterate or something like that. I'm not saying that those factors don't matter, but the 20% that makes the 80% is I'm just going to keep looking for the answer and keep trying different stuff and try to do it in an intelligent way. Like I'm not trying the same thing over and over again, right? But
yeah.
Okay, today I'm going to try this approach. Tomorrow I'll try this approach, and then the weeks can go by and you feel like you're not making progress. But progress happens in very big jumps. So you just have to believe that the big jump is going to happen.
Yeah. It just kind of flies by as you keep going. You just got to kind of have a goal in mind and make small goals to reach the end goal. But then during that kind of journey, you fall in love with the journey instead. And now you don't really have the end goal. It's more of just doing doing the journey. It's what it came down to with me, at least with the learning bytecode and, you know, all this stuff. The original intention was just, you know, be able to reverse engineer bytecode. And then it kind of went beyond that because it just was so fun. And then I got into like, you know, the dynamic static analysis, symbol execution, and now getting into AI, it's like, oh, this all came from an inherent curiosity of the topic and what is possible and what isn't available at the current moment. And, you know, the further you get into the knowledge is when you understand what is actually possible, what can be done, maybe highly improbable, but possible. And you can only understand that if you have a really solid understanding of the topic at the fundamental level. You wouldn't be able to automatically detect anomalies in bytecode without understanding bytecode, you know, at a deep level. And the patterns and, you know, the compiler as well, it all kind of plays in. And so I think that understanding of the topic at a super fundamental level is really something I stand by and I've had stood by for my entire career, I think. What do you think is the difference between a great researcher and just an average one? Obviously, not taking into account getting rid of the consistency factor. Sure, it can be a strategy, but maybe what kind of tactics are they using in their strategy to really optimize?
Right. That's a good question. Well, the thing, I don't know about tactics because tactics are very easy to adjust, right? Well, let's talk about another factor, which is luck, right? If you're if you happen to be working on a topic where you happen to be closer to a breakthrough than your peers, then that will make you a better researcher, right? So right. I think that's a factor that I see. I see some very smart people doing research in extremely difficult areas. And if they had just moved to a quote unquote easier field, then, you know, they would just be a celebrity basically. So that's a factor. I hear people saying, you know, what explains my success is the learning strategy that I'm using. I frankly think people are not very good at explaining their own successes because if you ask everybody, they give you a different answer. Like, oh, why are you successful? That's because I do breathing exercise and lift weights. Yeah. How come you're successful? Because, you know, I time myself to make sure that I will try a subject for a minimum of 2 weeks and not give up. And then if it doesn't work, then I'm going to force myself to pivot no matter what. And then all of these things sound really convincing. Like, oh, if I do that too, then it's going to make me successful, right? It's kind of like all of these people give saying, hey, this is my auditing strategy. And then some eager-eyed people are like, oh, I'm going to copy your auditing strategy because I want to be like you. It doesn't work that way. I think the best researchers or people who work out in general, they figured out a good match between what they're good at, what they're interested in, and where they're able to move the needle. Those are... Now, here I am trying to explain success when I just said it's kind of a silly thing to try to explain. So asterisk, fine print. Yes, I recognize the irony. But that's my assessment, having... I've interacted with... I think I can speak with some experience on the topic, right? Because I've taught dozens of students at this point. So I get to see some patterns in who succeeds and who doesn't. And then I've worked with researchers on very hard problems back in my academic past and then back at my previous job. And I see some people just... seem to consistently pull the rabbit out of the hat and other people don't. Attributing that entirely to randomness is a bit silly. So you can say some things about it.
I agree, actually. I recently learned this, but the hustle culture is so toxic, you know, in today's society of, you know, make a schedule, stick to it, have this specific routine, do X, Y, and Z forever, and to have the most optimal strategy objectively. But what it really comes down to, from my experience, at least, is how comfortable are you doing that? And obviously seek discomfort, but to a degree, I think you need routine that you're comfortable with to the point where you can be consistent, because consistency trumps everything, because it just compounds and compounds. And, you know, how are you going to beat the person that's going every day for X amount of hours, hyper-focused, right?
Right.
You can't, unless you're doing the same thing. You can't just do a one-off audit every, you know, every day or every couple days, whatever. If it's not consistent, then you can't really beat the consistent one, even though it might be a really suboptimal strategy of doing whatever they're doing. It might be just like brute forcing trial and error and eventually crack it one day. As long as they're consistent, that kind of wins everything. So I think progress, yep, no matter how big, it all adds up.
Yep, that's something I tell people before they embark on a learning journey and says, look, dude, consistent. You can be very excited now, but consistency will beat intensity over the long run. You can have the most perfect schedule for 3 months. It's just, you're just not going to beat someone who's been doing it for a year, right? And just by virtue of time, they've had opportunity to learn from their mistakes and iterate and figure out what works and what doesn't. It's really uncommon to see people who can stick to something for a year. I mean, I see that as an educator, right? Because there's a lot of people who, like on my Udemy courses, for example, I have a couple of bestsellers there on the topic of solidity and assembly. And, you know, the drop off rate on the online courses is kind of a ha 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 sort of a thing, right? People don't stick to it. Okay, that's fine. Some people are coming in to just figure out if they're interested in the subject in the first place or not, right? So let's trim that down. Still, the completion rate on most online stuff is not high. Is that due to a lack of discipline or due to people discovering that this is not something that works for them, like you were saying? I mean, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. The fact of the matter is the subject doesn't work for them. They're just not going to succeed in the long run. Whether it's due to a lack of interest or lack of discipline, it kind of doesn't matter, right? They're not in a situation where they're going to be consistent.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of how interested are you in the subject? How much pain or discomfort does it bring to do the thing? It comes down to, like, I think, emotions of love, hate, and just those two alone, actually.
Oh, I agree.
Fear as well.
In fact, because I used to think that, you know, okay, here, like, for example, I remember two people that I taught through Rare Skills. They were very junior, and I had very direct conversations with them and said, look, dude, I think it's not, you're too inexperienced as a general programmer. You getting a job at a blockchain company is a little bit idealistic, in my opinion. You should just try to get a regular job. But they would not take that for an answer. And they kept coming back for it, even though I kind of felt like it was a lost cause. And sure enough, they both got what they wanted. And I definitely did not expect that. And the differentiator there is they were really willing to hang in for unreasonable amounts of time. So that's because even if you're not where you need to be in order to accomplish what you want, if you just hang in there, then eventually you're getting closer and closer to having the abilities to get what you want. That's a very huge factor. I'm not saying talent doesn't matter, right? I think if you're going to be top 1% in the field, then you need to have some sort of a built-in advantage. But people really underestimate how much being a Tenacious Barnacle for a year can accomplish if you're somehow able to get to that point, which most people aren't.
Yeah, having the grit to go through all the pain and suffering for months on end, years on end, that alone will get you far. When you factor in talent and natural skill set, then I guess that creates the 1% or the highest level of expertise. But it really comes down to that consistency. And me personally, I am very consistent, like for months on end, but I do it so focused and so tunnel visioned in that way that I burn out for, minimum 1 month. And I'm kind of going through that right now, but I did the same last year. Seems to be a trend. Normal. During that burnout time, it's horrible, right? And you're like, wow, you can't do anything. At least for me, I was bedridden. I couldn't do anything for 6 weeks straight. But somehow it all came back. And I was like, wow, okay. It's not that I'm lazy or I don't have any determination. It's just some kind of psychological thing that I've endured as a human for focusing on something. And, I love this thing. I wouldn't do anything else. But during that period, I didn't like it anymore. I still liked it, but I couldn't get myself to do it, which was very weird. And, that is also something I'm trying to figure out. So I'm still early in my career, only 3 years, but how do you deal with burnout when it comes and also burnout prevention?
I've been through, I think you've largely figured it out. Burnout will happen, right? You could be doing everything right and still get burned out because there could be circumstances outside your control that make it hard not to burn out, right? But after you see yourself recover from the burnout enough times, then you just then you don't get too discouraged by it after the 11th time it happens, right? Yeah, this is just part of it. Because I've gone through those 2 week stretches where I'm sitting at my desk and doing basically nothing, right? And then I'm like, is something wrong with me because I'm supposed to be more productive?
Yeah, then you feel more guilty.
I definitely think that, but now I don't feel as guilty about it anymore. This is just part of the work. Now, maybe there's some like more optimal strategy, quote unquote, where I could avoid the burnout in the first place. I haven't figured it out. So like I said, you can't control all of the circumstances. Like let's say you're doing everything right and your house burns down. No pun intended, but I think you're going to feel a little burnt out, right? So, and what could you have done about that? Not really anything. So I don't know that there's an optimal strategy, right?
I agree. Like I was doing everything correct, I thought. And so one day it just ceased to exist. After a pure burning passion to do the thing. But also I think a contributor to it was the problems I was facing are extremely complex. And even simplifying it to a lower form still served to be complex because the intricacies of combining all the possibilities and combinations and trying to dwindle them down with no definitive answer, just kind of a state explosion in my brain. And then learning about other people's journeys, learning about AI from Lucas, from Pentestify, really like it was a combination of both that just like broke my mind. And I'm still trying to recover. But then I think it actually does contribute to difficulty of the task and how quickly can you do it? Because it comes to the point of if there are no rewards, not gaining anything of what you perceive as value, then it just seems like you're smashing your head against the wall. You're just trying to figure out this hard thing with no gain to come of it. And it could be like that for weeks, right? And that's when people quit and move on to something else. But I think to really have a breakthrough, you've got to keep going after that and not quit because it only ends if you choose to end it. Like you can have a roadblock for ages. I think of it like a flood in like a roadway. You can't get to the other side unless the flood dries up. And you can think of the burnout as that kind of flood.
You're right about the lack of rewarded things because people sometimes get burned out from being bored, right? It's not necessarily because they're... I saw this a lot in tech where people quit their job all the time, right? I'm doing boring stuff. I'm burned out. I quit. It's not like they were ever really challenged in what they were doing, right? It's just that they didn't feel... The rewards were not coming in fast enough. Yeah. But if you're working on a very hard subject, like then it's yeah, then it might be a very long time before a reward comes in, because if you're the first person to ever get that reward, you don't know how far away it is, right?
Yeah.
Like if you're leading a team of engineers or you're teaching students, then you can sort of you can introduce reward checkpoints, right? That's how these modern education platforms work. They try to have a lot of reward checkpoints, right? And I think that's how video games work too. But I've found I can keep people motivated by doing that, but I'm really cautious about using that technique because it's artificial. If you want to work on something, then you have to be okay with not knowing when the rewards are going to come in. That's something if you're, you know, like school doesn't prepare you for it. If you have if you work in a very well-structured company, then they know to keep the reward intervals at least somewhat predictable, right? So operating without that is quite hard, and a lot of people are not prepared for that.
And you truly face that when you're at the brink of innovation, when there's no research that's doing the exact same thing as you. You're trying to create that new research or push the bounds of what's possible. And that's where the grit really comes in, because, I mean, you can definitely get the reward, like the dopamine hits from the small tasks, you simplify from the larger one, but if the small ones are also extremely complex, then, you know, it's a tough game. And for me, that's especially true because thinking of heuristics of how to cover everything in a generalized sense in terms of bytecode pathways and like a CFG automatically, right? How do you identify vulnerabilities in a programmic way? And there's a lot that goes into that. It's not a trivial task. Obviously, you know the reward is going to be great when you finish it, but getting to that point is difficult. And, you know, I think it's all right to take a break for, you know, months. I've done that before. I took actually a couple months off when I was doing this current tool, and then I came back to it even stronger.
If something you're working on happens on the scale of years, then stopping for 1 month to maybe get it done 4 months sooner, actually, that can actually pay off. Because 1 month might feel like a long time, but if the scale of the project is much bigger than that, then it's not actually wasting time if you're getting energy back and giving your brain time to reset.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So another thing I deal with actually quite a lot is procrastination. I think a lot of people deal with this, but for me, holy, it's bad. Even though I've achieved a lot in a small time frame, procrastination has definitely played a big part, which, you know,
I've had a lot of hardworking people who say that, you know, that's interesting to hear, because whenever I'm talking to high performing people, they always feel like, but I could be doing better in this. I could be doing better in that.
I think it's more of like a mindset.
I'm not dismissing what you're saying, but I've heard that a lot. So that's why I made that comment.
It's interesting. I guess my mindset kind of developed into hyper-optimizing everything, and then disregarding the human element, you know, it's kind of being like a robot.
One thing I can say about it is if I'm working on an extremely difficult subject, like let's say I'm trying to work out a proof for ZKPs, I cannot do that for more than 4 hours a day, maybe 6 hours if I had a lot of rest and I'm very, like, don't have anything else stressing me out. So let's say I have to sleep for 8 hours, right? So that means there's 16 hours available and I used 6 hours of it in a way that I feel productive. Well, there's this other 10 where I feel like I'm not working on the hyper-focused, ultra-high impact thing. Yeah. So that's 10 hours of feeling like I'm procrastinating.
Yeah.
I've made peace for that because I know I cannot do hard math work for 16 hours in a row. Maybe some people can, but it's not me. And even if I'm going to do like the optimal thing, I'm going to wake up, you know, whatever, then work on it for 4 hours, go to the gym, come back. No, I mean, I can really see after the curve. At first it goes down very slowly and then it starts to drop off very fast. So I just have to make peace with what my limitations are. And work around that. So I try to make the other 10 hours not feel like they suck. Maybe I'll just do admin work, right? Or do some write tutorials that are easy to write. Like I've been writing some Uniswap tutorials recently because my brain is a little bit fried from ZKPs a little bit. So that gets me some nice little dopamine hits so the other 10 hours don't feel bad. That's something that took me a long time to learn.
I'm still trying to figure this out, but I think, you know, coming to the realization that we are just human and you do need a balance. You can't just be a robot, because that's how you aren't consistent, and consistency is really key. And I think that's why you hear a lot of personalized success stories, because what it comes down to is what makes you consistent? What kind of day lifestyle do you want to live? Do you want to live that will make you happy and enjoy your time basically doing what you want? You can live in a, you know, luxury place, right? But if you're not comfortable in that and don't really enjoy it as much as like living in the countryside on a farm, then how's that gonna, you can't just translate that over to, you know, a generalized population. It's all unique to everyone. So I think that's why there's so many different success stories and not just one size fits all kind of routine. You know, it's a, you got to adapt to your own brain and likings to be comfortable. I think that's what I've learned recently, is that you've got to be comfortable, because I moved countries, right, to be optimized for tax, but then I lost the quality of life I had back in Australia. And it turns out, even though I wasn't doing 0% tax, you know, 45 cents on the dollar, I achieved a lot more because I was comfortable and in a very fast paced, I guess, time frame, because I was comfortable and I could build a routine I could consistently do every single day. Even though it might seem suboptimal objectively, it was optimal for me specifically. And, you know, I wouldn't have cheated. I think that's actually a good point to touch on, is it may not be the objectively optimal strategy, but if it's suboptimal and you can do it for longer, then it is actually the most optimal, if that makes sense.
Right. Because if we think about what an optimal week looks like, it's easy to create an optimal week, but that doesn't translate into an optimal 80 weeks, right? So, and it's much harder to think about what does an optimal 80 weeks look like versus an optimal 1 week. Because we can look at our schedule over the course of 1 week and kind of plan out every hour, but you can't do that over the course of the year.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. When you take into account, it's hard to take into account the subjective perspective of the matter as well. Like, obviously, you can get a day down into paper of the routine of like, okay, I'm going to study 4 hours here, 1 hour break, 4 hours here, gym, dinner, whatever. And now you've got, you know, you can kind of create like 12 hours work and 8 hours sleep, whatever is the rest. But yeah, it's I don't know. I think you've got to really create the day so you enjoy it, so you can do it for a long period of time. Because we are just human at the end of the day, and emotions are a big factor. And I think even going through burnout is not necessarily a fun thing, but it's a good thing because we're experiencing human emotion. And that's kind of the point of life, you know, to experience this super low chance of, you know, that we've just drawn out of the deck of cards. But yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking of now, is just optimize my environment as much as possible so I'm enjoying life, so I can be more consistent. And, you know, taxes and whatever is just a fee I'm willing to pay for that, you know. So that's kind of what I've come to the conclusion now. Maybe it'll change in the future, it probably will, but that's what I've learned so far. I don't know if it's the same for you.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever thought about it in that framework, but the that definitely matches my experience, right? If you can't if your default behaviors don't, or if your default incentives and default circumstances don't lead you to what your long-term goals are, then it's going to be hard. You know, like people say, oh, if all of your friends go to the gym, then you're going to go to the gym too. That was something I experienced because I was good friends with a football, like an American football player in college, definitely. And he kept dragging me to the gym. And it's not because I wanted to go. It's just because my circumstances that was just the default, right? So I think I've thought about it in the framework of what are your environment's defaults are kind of what your long-term things are going to be. Where you say it has to be comfortable. So you want to have, you don't want to be in an environment that has something that's keep pushing you off track. Because you're not going to be able to fight that over the long haul.
Oh yeah. Environment is one of the biggest factors. If you're friends with, let's say, people that are doing drugs and partying every night or talking about it, not really doing too much, then you're going to adapt to that environment. Whereas if you're talking to people that are, you know, let's say millionaires, right? Then eventually it's going to rub off on you and you'll probably reach there, or at least learn how they got there and the clear pathway to get there. It's just inevitable. If you're surrounded by people doing it every day, then it's going to happen. And that's why I think friend groups are so important, and choosing the right people to be around you all the time. And even it might be better to just, if you can't find anyone, then just be by yourself and surround yourself in books, actually. Mm-hmm. Because that is a form of, you know, personalities that you've curated and chosen to be around every day, for, given you've formed the habit and are reading every day. But yeah, I thought of that as well. So there's also so many factors that come into this, really.
But oh, yeah, definitely.
The underlying is really just consistency and grit. And there's there's nothing to substitute that. If you're not going to do the thing, then building a plan to do it, you know, the most optimal thing, nothing of that matters if you don't do it. And it comes down to starting. And starting is actually interesting, because I think that's the hardest thing, because you think of the problem before you started it, and, you know, the discomfort of about to start, especially if it's a difficult task, is hard to overcome in your mind. And then you start procrastinating, then you feel guilty for procrastinating. And then, you know, a couple of hours go by, you start, and maybe your phone buzzes and your focus is gone. Now you've just in a, you know, a negative cycle looping. This is from personal experience.
I think we've all experienced that.
Yeah. And actually, another question I have is, you know, with the abundance of information out there, how do you filter out what's the most important?
I think our brain automatically filters knowledge. Anyway, this is something that one counterintuitive thing that I've learned over the course of doing a lot of teaching. There are some topics that simply cannot be taught over the course of a week. When I first designed courses, I had this, I think I made the same mistake all educators make, which is, oh, I want people who learn from me to know this and this and this and this. You know, I really want them to have a complete understanding of all of this stuff, because if they don't know that, then I'm a failure, sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. But actually seeing, okay, what is feasible over the course of the week? So my favorite example is elliptic curves. I've never seen anyone, regardless of how smart they are, unless they had a very serious math background, really understand that in over the course of a week. Now, they can start getting some idea of about it over the course of the week, but if you ask them probing questions, then they are not able to get it. And what I've seen with that is, okay, why do our brains throw away knowledge so much, even though we sort of have a very strong desire to learn it in the first place? Well, I think it's just because we're on information overload. If you want your brain to really get something, I mean, okay, part of it is the topic of the complexity of the topic, right? That is one factor. But at the end of the day, elliptic curves are not that complicated. I mean, in terms of how they operate, but getting your brain around it for the first time seems harder, a lot harder than it should be. At least once you already know the subject, then you feel like, oh, it should be easy for other people to understand that. But that's not the case. And I think my hypothesis, and this is a conclusion I've arrived at maybe like a month ago, so subject to change, but by default, our brain just throws away information. So you're trying to, hey, brain, understand this concept. And the brain's like, no, I've been seeing too much information. I'm just going to throw it away. But if you keep at it for 2 weeks, then the brain starts to get the hint that, oh, okay, this guy spent 4% of the year trying to get me to understand this. Maybe it's something I should not throw away. And then that's when things really start to click in. So I wouldn't worry about filtering information, because our brain filters it anyway. If the question is, how do we get our brain to really focus on information we want it to focus on, it's stick with it for 2 weeks or longer. That seems to be the threshold at which the brain stops rejecting information, at least information that is not so trivial that it easily fits into an existing framework we already have, right? Because if I were to, let's say we were discussing something like, oh, we introduced a new opcode in Ethereum, right? You could probably learn that in one day, but that's because you have such a strong grasp of how opcodes do. It's not, it already fits into something your brain has accepted as important. But if it's something that feels very foreign, then the brain treats it as foreign information and something to reject at first.
Yeah. I remember seeing this, I can't remember where, but instead of cramming everything, I think this is actually a flaw in schools as well, especially when it comes to exams or any kind of test. People cram in the last, you know, week or night, but the reality is, you know, the synapses in your neurons, and they only strengthen over a long period of time. And so spaced repetition is what strengthens that. You can do, you know, you start a subject, you do it the next day, you do it maybe the next day as well, but obviously the more frequent you're doing it, so every day it's going to strengthen quicker. But if you're doing it, let's say, you know, one day, then back-to-back days, and then maybe one day in between, and then 2 days in between, eventually get to a week, and then a month, you're still going to retain that information. Otherwise, it just kind of goes away, right? Yeah. And that's why, you know, you learn something in school, let's say math, right? And then you never use it. But eventually one day you'll use it and you're reminded of it. You're like, oh, wait, I remember this. And that's, I don't know specifically what happens in the neurons, but they refire and then you have to keep doing that for a little bit. It's kind of like your brain focuses on stuff when it's triggered, like it gets fired, and you can strengthen that synapse, or you can think of it as like the bridge between two neurons, and from just doing it over and over again. And that's why specializing is actually, I think, better. And you can do like, actually a really good thing I've been doing is trying to cross multiple disciplines together. So when my strategy has always been, when I want to learn something new, how can I relate it to the current thing I'm doing? And I did this my entire career. When it was Solidity, I was like, okay, how can I go the next step beyond while doing the same thing? And the next step was assembly. And you can use inline assembly in Solidity, right? Mm-hmm. And then I got a new interest in reverse engineering. And so I was like, all right, how can I do this? Oh, let's build a tool to automate it. And so I was doing the assembly slash and bytecode to go into reverse engineering. So I was like hitting two topics. And then I went from reverse engineering to, you know, dynamic static analysis, symbolic execution, because it was still the same, I guess, field, maybe subfields within it though, but like the broad category. And then I guess each item within that category, it's still within the category. Mm-hmm. And then the next step is AI, and that's the cross-discipline kind of part, but you can still interrelate them to each other to understand two things at once. And I think that's been a prime helper of me learning something quickly, because you're still doing the same thing every day, but learning something new, but it's intertwined. So you have a reference to fall back on instead of learning completely from scratch.
But that definitely informs like how I write my articles and how I tell the people on the team to write articles, technical ones especially, is you need to have a really strong opinion about what does this person already know, springboard off of that. Now, sometimes that can feel risky, right? Because, oh, if I refer to something that they don't actually know, then everything's going to fall apart all of a sudden. The payoff, I've found that, like, okay, yes, that can definitely happen. But most of the positive feedback is like, okay, oh, Jeffrey, you helped me understand a difficult topic very quickly. Well, that's because I was trying to keep it, I had a pretty good idea of what the reader's like, and I'm trying to keep it close to something they're already familiar with and rely on that versus building from the ground up each time, right? Or something similar to that. Yep. If you explain too many new concepts at once, then it doesn't matter how clear your explanations are, it's just exhausting to read it. Right. So it's better if you can skip that and try to make a lucky guess on what the person already knows that you can relate to, then more often than not, it's going to work out well.
Yeah, definitely. Starting from a point of reference with established knowledge is so much easier than starting from complete scratch, I think. In some cases, actually, a lot of companies, they prefer you to have no experience from competing companies so they can ingrain the kind of, what would you say, values and goals and ways they approach problems to match the people within the company. But I think, I don't know, maybe it's a mixture, but it seems if they're interrelated, then it makes sense, a pre-existing knowledge. But obviously we all start from somewhere, right? But that somewhere is always the hardest part. And then once you hit a point of understanding, it becomes so much easier and way more fun, because not understanding something is pretty frustrating and very demotivating. And that's, again, where the consistency comes in, because given enough time, eventually you'll crack it. Well, more probability of doing it than not, you know? Interesting. So when you do start from researching a topic from scratch, what is your methodology for that?
Sure. Now, that it's largely about asking questions over and over again, at least for me. Well, I guess I can give an example of, okay, I want to do a walkthrough for Tornado Cache. For example, it took me a long time to write that, the handbook for that. So when you start off, there's just a long list of questions, right? Well, first of all, there's the really obvious questions, which is like, okay, how do we disassociate the depositor from the withdrawer? Okay, that's fine. Okay, we use a Merkle tree to track everything that's going on in there. All right, well, how do you, if you're updating the Merkle tree as part of the transaction, then how on earth do you do that on chain? Because that's going to run out of gas. Well, then that leads to an exploration of like, oh, okay, this is why they've used an incremental Merkle tree. Okay, that's great. How come they picked, I don't know, this depth of the Merkle tree, right? Because, you know, you get two to the n, the depth of the number of leaves, right? Here's something I got stuck on for a long time. Like, why is the hash function that they're using not appearing in anywhere of the code? If that's something you could just rush off, oh, they have an interface to it, so I guess I know what it behaves like. But what's actually going on there? Okay, that leads to, okay, they've built the bytecode from scratch for a ZK-friendly hash function because they couldn't write it efficiently in Solidity and they had to deploy it somewhere else. Okay, well, if that really exists, then that means I should be able to find it on chain somewhere, right? Where is it actually? So those are all consistently asking questions. Like, so I guess maybe this is an easier example because it's more recent. I'm having some people write an article on EigenLayer, and the claim is, oh, you should be able to inherit the L2 security or L1 security, right? Mm-hmm. All right, cool. But how exactly? All right. What if the tokens rebase? How are they handling that? If you can stake for multiple applications on top of EigenLayer, does that dilute the security? Okay, what if someone's misbehaving in one protocol but not another? How do they handle that? So these are all questions that keep the research manageable, right? So only if you try to read the entire code base at once, it's going to be pretty overwhelming. But if it's just, I need an answer to this specific question, and then show me the code where, don't, you know, read the documents carefully and then try to interpolate the answer, actually read the code. That will inform what question you should be asking next, and then that leads to another trail of questions, and eventually run out of questions to ask. Unless you're in a research, like with a code base walkthrough, you run out of questions because it's a finite information. If you're doing research, then you never run out of questions and you have to be careful. That's my preferred approach for exploring a new topic, or at least that's what I find myself doing by default. I used to, okay, well, let's just look at all the, like, if it was exploring like a code base, let's just look at all the public variables and all the public functions, right? Because that should be important. But it's kind of, I found it in my head harder to separate out, to taxonomize the information. At least it didn't come naturally to me. Maybe some people do that, but I found that to be a bit unnatural for me. So those asking questions and then trying to stick around until I find the answer, that seems to be the default mode that I go into. Now, the danger is you can get stuck on one question for a very long time. So you have to really balance that out and be okay with the fact that some questions are very hard to answer and you just have to put in the work. That was my guiding thing. That was how I studied like the ZK proof stuff is, okay, the verification formula is set up like this, but why? Okay, well, what if I try to attack it in this way? Okay, how come that attack fails? Those are how I would. Yeah. Funny enough, asking myself these questions helps anticipating the times when students ask me, because sometimes I'm very prepared for the question. But even if they don't, at least for me, it led to developing a mental model of the subject.
Yeah, I definitely think asking questions, continuously asking questions until you get to the bare bones answer where there's no more questions, is the way to fully understand something. I do that right now with the complex problems I face. It's just keep on asking until there's no more questions, actually. Then you get a result, right? And then, you know, the way we learn is not with what is happening. I think it's why things happen, you know? And this is something I've recently found out, but I'm even applying to things I'm doing now. But, you know, to truly understand something, you got to understand why, not necessarily what. You can understand something at the what level. For example, a hack, you can understand the hack completely, the steps that, you know, go line by line. Sure, now you understand the hack, but you got to understand why was this used instead of something else? What's the underlying meaning of doing this? I think for math, especially with the intuition, is why are you doing, you know, this change with the equation to expand it or compress it. It's not necessarily what's happening, because without the why, you'll never intuitively know the what. And this is especially true of math, is what I've found out. It's more particularly like algebra specifically. But I think just asking the questions of why is will give you a lot of insight. From my experience,
I think that's where some programmers can get stuck, is because if you get the how right, then you can get a paycheck, right? So I know how to make this thing work, but then whereas you don't really get paid to explain why does the system work and why does your code work and whatnot, but that in the long term doesn't really help you tackle hard problems where you don't know the how. For hard problems, we don't know the how, right? So if you're not comfortable with exploring the why, then the how will be hard to explore also.
I mean, you could just like throw a bunch of I guess you look at the docs and just throw in different functions and experiment, but if you don't understand the function at its level, I mean, you know, if you don't understand what's happening with the function, you know, what's actually happening, why you should use this one over another one. I mean, you can really just like throw a bunch of code together and it works, and you can explain how it works, but you can't explain why. And I think particularly with the harder subjects involving math, like ZK and like machine learning, you need to understand the why. You do X over Y, or you know, do it one strategy over another, because you would learn there's more optimization, or there's might be a vulnerability in doing another way. And then you can formulate the how after you think of the why.
Yep.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think it goes for learning as well. You know, it's a, why are you learning this? What's the point of this? And then mm-hmm. you have the point, and now, okay, how do you learn this? And then that's kind of the approach I've developed. But yeah, hopefully this helps a lot of people, because I, you know, this is from years of experience, right? Of like trial and error. Try and think of these methodologies. And yeah, even if people have the years of experience, they might have found a different path, and this would be really insightful. So yeah, thank you so much for jumping on, Jeff. I really appreciate the time spent with you, and it's been very interesting.
Sure thing. Thank you.
No problem. All right, man. Take care.
Okay. Have a good one.